Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. For those who are hoping to have Scott Lockwood, I'm sorry to disappoint you. he asked me to swap with him, and I was happy to do that. So you've had me 2 weeks in a row, so therefore you'll have indigestion by the time that we finish today. Oh dear. I've been cultivating a little bit of a chest cold here. It's been sitting on the verge just down below, no problems, nothing all week, and today I feel good, but I'm a little croaky, so just to warn you, don't kiss me. Those who want to fling themselves at me. All right. But, Robert was reminding me of forgetting things in old age and things, and I like to go into my little local bank, and the young ladies behind the counter are all pretty. You know, when you get old, every young lady looks beautiful. You know that? Every one of them, just pretty as pictures. Anyway, they're standing behind the counter, and I like to tell them lousy jokes. They really are lousy jokes, but they're good, because they don't expect it. So, Crystal was standing there and said, "Oh, hello, Arthur, how are you?" I said, "Well, I'm fine, thanks very much, Crystal, how are you?" "Oh," she said, "good," and I made the deposit, and then I said, "You know, when you get old, you tend to forget a lot." She said, Josh, it was like this old guy. He was a widower, and there was another lady who was a widow. No, the other way around. No, that's right. And he married this elderly lady, and they were just so much in love, and everyone knew them in their little local church, and he'd call her sweetheart, and honey bun, sugar plum, and daffodil, and all sorts of wild, affectionate names because they were so much in love. And one day someone said to him, "Well, you know, you're so cute, you're so nice calling your wife all these lovely names." He said, "Yeah." He said, "You know, problem is I can't remember her name." She just about dropped her false teeth when I told her that one. Oh, well. Anyway, we've had a good week. I hope you have too. I always enjoy the Sabbath day. It's only been 50 years. And I keep saying that as a reminder to myself because, you know, I never expected it to be this long. when we first came into the church, all hell and damnation was going to break out. We were going to go to the place of safety. Everyone else was going to die. Yada, yada, yada. Cheers. Getting old is easy to do. I love movies. I don't know if you love movies, but I love movies. Part of my master's degree program was in film criticism. And I just love movies because they really do tell a good story. I want to recommend a movie which Marcia and I went out on a date on Monday and saw The Iron Lady. Does anyone know who The Iron Lady is? Would you raise your hands if you know who The Iron Lady is? Okay, a lot of you don't. That was the nickname given to Mrs. Margaret Thatcher, who was Prime Minister of England for 11 years. Now, I just happened, believe it or not, to be living in England in that time. And so I'm very aware of this period of English history or British history. She reigned from 1979 to 1990. And in England at the time, there were comments like, or there were plays rather, which made fun of the Prime Minister's husband. And the title of the play in the West End at the time was Poor Dennis. Poor Dennis. And Poor Dennis obviously lived a very different life. He was a small businessman. He married Margaret when they obviously were young, and she just began her political career, and they had two children, twins, a boy and a girl in this instance, and from then on she, Margaret, was involved in political life. She eventually got elected, and eventually she took over, she challenged the Conservative Party, which would be equal to the Republican Party here. She challenged Edward Heath, who was the Prime Minister, and she took over leadership of the Conservative Party and then eventually became Prime Minister, and as it said, she reigned for 11 years. The period of time in the 70s was a period of turmoil in England. When you go and see the movie, and I hope you do, and I recommend it for various reasons, and I'm not going to tell you too much about it, but in England at the time there was an enormous struggle for power. The unions and the miners were up in arms against the government. The mines were being shut down. The miners were saying, we're not going to have the mines shut down. Margaret Thatcher wanted to install a poll tax so that everybody would pay taxes. Remind you of something in the United States right now, about what, 49% of people don't pay taxes. She wanted everybody to pay a fair share of taxes. And the result of this was, as one member in the Nottingham Church, which I was pastoring at the time in England, one of the three, the father and the mother employed their son, who was a coal miner, and he was a big lad, and they employed him, said, we don't want you going down on the strike line. People were getting killed. And so they employed him to paint their house inside and out so he wouldn't go down and be exposed to the violence that was taking place in England. You know, it was very bad. It was very bad. And the rioting that took place makes the Wall Street sitting look like patty cake, baker's man. You haven't seen it until you've seen it. And Wall Street was nothing compared to what was taking place in the 70s. England went without power for most of the day. We had 2 or 3 hours of electrical supply. Shops had candles burning in them. We were asked to turn off the lights at night and not to, quote, waste electricity. Can you imagine in a nation as advanced as England that this was the state that things got to? Garbage was piled up in the streets outside Parliament in central London. The place began to stink because no one would pick up the garbage. It was a very, very bad time. Maggie, as she is known, stood her ground. She fought the unions. She beat them down, leading her Conservative Party. And England began to come back to a little bit of sense because the back of the power of the unions was broken. They had lost. It had cost them a tremendous amount of money. And as a result of that, during that time, England was almost bankrupt. Hello, $16 trillion of debt, America. Hello, are we awake? England was almost bankrupt, and it needed strong leadership to come out of that. What happened in 1982? Anyone know what happened in 1982? The Falkland Islands was invaded by Argentina, or the Argy-Barges, as we would call them over there. And so then, at a time of financial crisis, just having got over an economic crisis with the unions and a political crisis, the nation then was asked, do we go and protect the Falklands? Does anyone know where the Falkland Islands are not? You don't know where they are. You do. Who knows where the Falkland Islands are? Okay, for some that don't, way, way, way down the bottom of South America and just off the coast of Argentina. Okay, young people, look at your maps. Know your geography. All right, so there, way, what was it, about 2.5-3 weeks travel away from England, steaming at 10 to 12 knots, the Admiralty then was asked, should we defend the Falklands? Should we accept this invasion of territory which was ours? And what should we do? She made the hard-nosed decision. We will protect our sovereign right. And 3 weeks later, the counter-invasion took place, and in about a week or 10 days, they were routed from that island territory of Great Britain. That was the sort of woman she was, and it was a time that Really, England couldn't afford that war. But she would not give in, and she stood on principle. She's called the Iron Lady for a good reason, because of her strong will. They also produced a £1 gold or brass coloured coin called a Maggie. And it was called a Maggie because it was small, hard and brassy. Okay, so that's, you know, that's the sort of people the English are. They take the mickey quite a bit. Now, very sadly, she is still alive today, but Mrs. Thatcher has dementia. And much of the film is about that and her family and how she handled it, how they handled it. So I'd recommend you go and see that. Now, after the movie, Marcia and I got out and drove in our car just across the street to Target. We went in Target to pick up various things, you know, some stationery and this and bits and bobs, shoe polish, small stuff like that. And as we were leaving, going through the checkout, there was a lady behind us and her husband started walking out and she pointed over there to something and he went like that. He was a tall man and grey hair, balding, and walked out. We went through the checkout and then we walked out, so this lady was still behind us. What happened next was, as we got to the door, here was this man, flat on his back, blood pouring out of his head, shaking violently as though he were having a fit. And we stopped and looked. There was a security there and two or three other people. There was nothing we could do. So I said to Marcia, come on, let's move away and let them get on and take care of them. 911 came, the fire truck came pretty shortly after that, and we don't know what happened. And I said to Marcia, let's just say a quick prayer for that family in the car. And just as we were getting to the car, the wife came out, saw the state of her husband, and the only way I can describe it is she began wailing. And that horrible cry, that horrible fear, looking at her husband there in a pool of blood, shaking uncontrollably. This was quite a sobering thing. The moment from seeing this life on celluloid, and then seeing a life potentially ebbing right in front of you there, and the suddenness of it all. You never know what a day will bring. You never know what to expect. And it impressed me again that time is running out and we don't know when ours will run out. And it's critical and important to realize that life is temporary. We say it tongue-in-cheek, we're biodegradable, indeed we are, and the only thing we can take with us is our character, which is then saved by God spiritually to be put in another body. Ezekiel 33, the valley of dry bones, is a metaphor for us to understand a resurrection. And have you ever asked yourself the question, why did God call me now? Why did God call us now? Why did God call me back in 1962 in the Persian Gulf? I don't know. That was the first knock on the door for me. Why did God call you whenever he called you? Young people, what is God doing with you? Because, simply to answer the question, he has a plan for us all as individuals. But what is that plan? What is your vision of what God's doing here and now with you? What did he call you for? I'm going to give you an answer perhaps that you're not expecting. He called us to prepare to be leaders. He called us to prepare to be leaders. Here, yes, and now, yes. But more specifically, and further in the future, for the world tomorrow, to be leaders. Margaret Thatcher made a very interesting statement. She said, you cannot lead from the crowd. You cannot lead from the crowd. How true that is, how simple it is. In other words, you've got to be out front. You've got to be doing something out front, leading positively in life, in order to be a leader. God has called us to, and I'm going to use the title of the sermon now, ahead of our time. God has called us to be ahead of our time. What do I mean by that? Ahead of our time. We've all grown up not knowing the way of peace. Isaiah chapter 59 verses 4 through 8 talks about that. Isaiah 59 verses 4 through 8. We've all grown up not knowing the way of peace, not being taught the way of peace. I grew up in World War II London. My first memories are bombs and bombed houses and soldiers and tanks and night, the searchlights at night and barrage balloons in the sky and railings around. And these are my first memories. Everything around us was bombed. We were lucky we weren't bombed, but you know, many houses were, many people killed. That was normal life for me. And blackout curtains, and turn out the lights and don't make a noise, and things like this. Verse 4 of Isaiah 59. No one calls for justice, nor does any plead for truth. They trust in empty words and speak lies. Does that apply today? Yes, it does. They conceive evil and bring forth lawlessness, which is what the word iniquity means. They hatch viper's eggs and weave their spider web. He who eats of their eggs dies, and from that which is crushed a viper breaks out. Their web will not become garments, nor will they cover themselves with their works. Their works are the works of lawlessness. The act of violence is in their hands. Their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are the thoughts of lawlessness or iniquity always. Wasting and destruction are in their paths, and the way of peace they have not known. There is no justice in their ways. They have made themselves crooked paths, and whosoever takes that way shall not know peace. And here we are as a society. We do not have peace, generally speaking, in our society. We do not have peace internationally. We've got threats and struggles for power. And as Hans J. Morgenthau wrote in his book, Politics Among Nations, we're either in one of three stages, recovering from war, preparing for a war, or engaged in war. And that's the way it's been all of my known life. All of my life. There's always war, always struggle, always the struggle for power, to dominate and to control. Always been that way. Our calling is to learn the way of peace. You won't learn it in society, typically. I hope you're learning it here. This is where we should be learning it. Isaiah 30 and verse 21. Isaiah 30, verse 21. Your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, this is the way, walk in it. Whenever you turn to the right hand or the wherever you turn to the right hand, or whenever you turn to the left. We often use this at the Feast of Tabernacles. I want to use it in a slightly different way. I want to emphasize it in the manner of being peaceful here and now, learning and understanding peace here and now in our congregation, in our workplace, in our environment, in our families, being peaceful here and now and understanding the way of peace and knowing the way of peace, so that we may learn the lessons of peaceful leadership for the world tomorrow. Here is the work environment. Here is the work environment. We did not just come to learn about the Ten Commandments. We didn't just come to learn about the holy days. We didn't just come to be nice people and tithe. We came for an interpersonal, inside education. Now, maybe you didn't know that, but that's what we're here for. We're to have a mind change, an attitude change, an approach change. So what is leadership? It's nebulous to define. I read one brilliant piece that I've looked and looked and looked and I just can't find it, but it was a politician who wrote of all of the aspects of leadership. And at the end of this paragraph, the man said, you know, we say all of these things about leadership, but we really don't know what it is. But we know it when we see it. Think about it. You look at a class of kids, you can see who are the leaders in that class. You can see who are the leaders in that class. So, I want to talk to you today about a man that was ahead of his time. Okay? We are wanting, I'm encouraging, that we are training to be ahead of our time. I want to talk about a man who was ahead of his time. He's long dead. His name is Sir Ernest Shackleton. He was born in 1874 and died in 1922. He was alive during the reign of Queen Victoria. I say that she died in 1901 and she reigned from 1819 onwards, approximately. That society, which I understand, was a very strict hierarchical society. It was class distinction in the rule. If you did not have the right amount of money, the right amount of comments, the right connections, go to the right school, you were dirt. And we were dirt. We grew up in London. We came from the coal mining fields of South Wales. My family wasn't wealthy and well educated. And we've had to kick and claw and scrape to get to where we are today. And God gave me the opportunity to do that. To understand the era, we would have to understand that class distinction. Is anyone watching Downton Abbey by any chance on PBS, Masterpiece Theatre from England? That is an idyllic portrayal of really what took place. If the separation between upstairs and downstairs was much, much greater than that, much, much greater. There would never have been this social interaction to the degree that they portray it in Downton Abbey. By the way, it's a very interesting period of time that they're portraying, from approximately just before World War One through to, well, after that, it was about 1900 approximately, and they just got through World War One, the Great War, which 22,000 men died in one day charging into the bullets that were fired at them. 22,000. And General Haig said, when he was asked how the war was going, he said, we should win. He said, well, you sound very confident. He said, yes, I am. We had 5 million men under arms. The Germans had 2.5. We shall win. Thank you. I hope they run out of ammunition, kind of thing, before they get to me. This was the era of great rigidity, if you will. And the perspective of Sir Ernest Shackleton is through the eyes of an explorer. He went down to the Antarctic to try to be one of the, or the first, to go to the South Pole. Okay, he'd been down previously. There had been previous other episodes down there. Captain Charles Hall went in 1871. He was the first American to attempt to reach the South Pole. His leadership was so fraught with dissension that his men poisoned him. Does that tell you something about his leadership? The second one was in 1890 by Admiral Robert Peary. His men accused him of treating them with total brutality, intolerant brutality, and blamed him for two suicides. And he had to overcome that. The third one was Adolphus Greely, who was also an American. He lost 19 of his 25 men. And he was forced to defend himself against a charge of cannibalism. Can we imagine the sort of circumstances that people were in? Minus degrees, 17, 18, 20. They would go typically for 2 years at a time. And then we have Captain Scott. which I remember reading stories about as a boy, Captain Scott, who did achieve reaching the South Pole. I'll say that sadly, I don't know if it was sadly or not, but as circumstances portrayed themselves, Captain Scott got there 4 weeks after a Swede called Amundsen, who did it with dog sleighs, and Scott walked. He reached it and came back and died in the wilderness of the Antarctic, frozen to death, without food. And as a boy, I remember reading in the stories of Captain Scott. There was an expression in England at the time, "Great Scott!" Don't know, have you heard it? "Great Scott." Because they looked on Scott as a great man. Why did they look on Scott as a great man? Well, he had charged out into the South Pole and he made it. He was coming back and he died in the effort. What a brave man. He may have failed to be the first there, but he was a tremendous example and he died in the attempt. What a great man. Sounds good, doesn't it? Sounds good. What is the reality? I'm going to compare and contrast Captain Scott with our friend Shackleton. Shackleton, born 1914, went to the Antarctic 1914 to 1916. Shackleton was a failure. Shackleton was a failure. What do we say about a man who failed to successfully reach any goal he set? Failed. He led only 27 people, the largest group he ever led. On his last trip, he never got anywhere, got stuck on a huge ice floe. Ship was trapped in ice and eventually the ship sank. What failure? Would you follow Shackleton? I wouldn't blame you for having doubts. Would you have confidence in him? Before you answer, let me add some telling details that made it a difference. Number one, his approach to his men. Shackleton did not follow the crowd in leadership. He led the crowd. Just because other people did it differently didn't mean to say that he should follow that. For example, here's a compare and contrast. I'll read these quickly. Scott trained in the Royal Navy and was highly disciplined. Shackleton trained in the Merchant Marine. Scott, rigid and formal. Shackleton, warm, flexible, but disciplined. For Scott, the prize was always paramount. For Shackleton, safety of his men was primary. Scott hired men of discipline and the results were, quote, unfortunate. Shackleton hired qualified and cheerful men. Scott was dour, bullying, and controlling. Shackleton was warm, humorous, and cheerful. Scott tormented his underlings. Shackleton teased, but never humiliated. Scott was orchestrated every movement. Shackleton gave responsibility and independence for decision-making to his men. Scott orchestrated every movement. Shackleton gave, talked openly and frankly about his work. Scott put his team at risk to meet his goals. Shackleton gave up his quest to save his men. Scott was hierarchical in organization. Shackleton was egalitarian and squashed down differences between his men and flattened out hierarchy. Scott was wary of colleagues who were more able than he, and Shackleton gave men credit for their expertise. Scott was arrogant. Shackleton was gregarious and humble. Scott was an indifferent selector of men. Shackleton was an effective selector, trainer, and innovator. Scott had a bad safety record for his men's lives. Shackleton had an excellent record. Scott did not share his vision with his men. Shackleton believed that all of his men must share his vision. Did you change your mind now? Do you change your mind? Might you want it to have followed Shackleton rather than Scott? I would. He was a man ahead of his time because of his way of thinking, of handling and dealing with his men. Note the differences. Throughout his life, he was known to be a man ahead of his time in his treatment of his men. Ultimately, his authority as leader rested on his genuine regard and respect for the men he led and their respect in return for him. If the person leading is not respected, if he doesn't give respect, then you won't have good leadership and you won't have a good team. History recorded Scott this way. For Scott and his four companions had died earlier in the year of 1912 on their trek back from the South Pole. Having arrived 1 month after Amundsen's party, the public became obsessed with Scott's sacrifice, which fit the romantic image of the Victorian age hero. Maybe others had beaten him to the pole. The public reasoned, but he had paved the way and paid the ultimate price for it. History proves that Scott took too little food with him. His men got scurvy and died from starvation and cold in the Antarctic. Whereas Shackleton, when he realised only 95 miles from the Antarctic South Pole, he said, "Guys, we've got to turn around and go back. We can't make it." What a wonderful difference. What we see is a leader truly prepared to stand on principle and lead lovingly and kindly. Our goal is to learn God's mentality for the world tomorrow. I think we could learn a lot. If you want to read the book, it's a wonderful book. It's called Shackleton's Way. I picked this up about 9 years ago. I'm on my second or third read of it. I don't just read a book once. I go through, mark it up. I go through, I make notes on paper. I go through and read it a third time. That's just my mind. I need to do that. If I had a photographic memory, it would save me a lot of time, but I don't. So I munch through these things, and wonderful, wonderful book. Wonderful lessons to be learned. And we are here to learn, and I believe if you got the book and read through it and saw the attitudes and the mentalities he had for that period of time in British history, it was unbelievable that anyone would think this way. He got everybody, whether the person had a PhD or was a seaman, working side by side, scrubbing the decks. To draw an analogy, all of us picking up the chairs and putting them away. Or someone picking up the broom and sweeping it. It doesn't matter. Everyone pitches in and does something, and that's how it should be. And that was his perspective. We're a team. We work together. Whatever the job needs to do, we'll get together and do it. And we all have responsibilities. And that improved camaraderie. It improved friendship. And you know what? Eventually, those men just went ahead and helped out without being asked, no matter what their social status was, from the scientist to the seaman. They work together. And I think there's a wonderful analogy for us as people of God as to what we should be doing. Working together in harmony. He was not dour. He was not harsh. He was not punitive. He was not controlling. Turn to Matthew chapter 20, please. Matthew chapter 20, and I would just like to read one verse. This has been gone over before just recently. If you'll just look at the scripture and read what it says about the two brothers and mum wanted her kids to be one on the right hand and one on the left hand of Jesus in the kingdom. And, you know, the struggle for power was taking place. And then when the rest of the disciples heard it, they got mad and upset about it. And that's verse 24. Now verse 25. Jesus called them to himself and said, "You know that rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them." In the 50 years of the church, we've experienced this quite well. We had a hierarchical structure. We had ranks in the ministry, and we had evangelists and preaching elders and pastors and preaching elders and local elders and unemployed local elders, and we had super deacons and we had less super deacons and high octane sub deacons. We can be a little facetious here, and it was hierarchical form. Well, we don't have that today, do we? We don't have that today. And why not? Because really, brethren, as you look at it, we were no different in certain regards than IBM, the Army, the Catholic Church, you name it. Hierarchical corporate structures. And we're not like that today. As Roy Holiday said, we've all been squashed flat. I like that. We've all been squashed flat. Why? There's no need for anyone to be the nail that stands up. As the old Chinese proverb says, the nail that stands up shall be hammered down. But that does not stop responsibility from being exercised or appropriate. We all have a responsibility. I have a responsibility, what I say to you. You can't absorb that responsibility for me. We have to do it. But we're here together as a unit, and we're not viewing things as the way of the Gentiles or the other nations. We only have to look around us now in our nation to see a political party that is bent ideologically on establishing socialism. So go look at the Iron Lady. Go see what happened to socialism in England in the 70s, which we experienced, and see what will happen in the streets of America. There's actual factual footage of the rioting that took place. And it wasn't pretty. And we're heading down this road now with our hell-bent towards socialism, and we're getting further and further in debt. This is not a party political speech, but unless we change this and stop it, as it is, it's going to take probably a whole generation to dig our way out of it, if we become extremely conservative, economically speaking. But look what's happened to Greece. They've been downgraded to the lowest level possible on the bond grading system, and they're still rioting because of the harsh cutbacks. Well, who's spending the money? Who's in debt? It has to do with socialism. I'm going to take from you to give to you. It's very, very simple. Very simple. That is not God's way. God's way of leadership is different. As we compared and contrasted Captain Scott of the Antarctic and Shackleton, and we went through that list, which form of leadership would you like to follow or emulate? I'd rather be with Shackleton any day. We have been called out of the world and its ways, have we not? Well, we may be as far as Sabbath, holy days, clean unclean foods, tithing, and so forth. My concern is that our minds have not yet grasped certain elements of loving humility that God wants us to have in our relationships with each other. That's my great concern. That's my great concern. Now, I say that from a personal point of view. It's been a long time getting here, personally. A long time. Why? I was in the dark. I was in the dark like a lot of people were in the dark. This is the way it was. This is what I came into. This is the way we do it. My youngest son said to me, "You know, Dad, you do have a somewhat of a militaristic streak in you." Really? I would never have known that. I only went to 2.5 years of a boarding school with 240 other boys, which was military. And we had World War II vets. I was taught to put your dukes up and fight in the boxing ring. Everybody got in the boxing ring and had 3 2-minute rounds with 20-ounce gloves on. I was taught you had to fight. I was taught if you spoke out of place, you got 2 bruises on the backside of your cheeks and they were about that long and lasted for 1 week or 10 days. I learned you had to keep your mouth shut, because if you didn't, pow, by bigger boys. And that was just at 13 to 16. They went in the Royal Navy and we had more of the World War II vets, only these were younger and more active. And you minded your P's and Q's. You minded what you said. These were tough men that had seen battle, seen death. They didn't shrink. Had 6 years in the Navy. So I've had 8.5 years of young to a little bit older in life, military. Well, what do you expect? Of course I've got a military streak to me. I've also got a nice side. Now my struggle is making sure that the nice side dominates. That's my struggle. And it's an emotional struggle in a certain regard, because depending on your family background, depending on your upbringing, depending on your personality, depending on what type of person you are, you might want to be a right-wing extremist. On the other hand, you might want to be a socialistic softbody. You see, we all come from different places. We all have different family backgrounds. We all have different experiences. And the point is that all of us come to a mindset more like Sir Ernest Shackleton, where he looked out for his men, where he taught teamwork, where his first responsibility was to take care of them, and he did. He got them all back alive after an arduous, horrible, unbelievable journey, but they all got back alive, didn't lose a one of them. He had his priorities right with his goals. You know, you can be right sometimes and so right you're fully wrong. Haven't we learned that? I trust. And when we look at John 15, we will see what Jesus said, because that's the struggle we all have of not just doing what we look to do in the church of Sabbath and holy days, not to minimize those, they're important, but you know, they're on the outside, they're just behaviors we all do and it's easy to do them. It's here, it's inside that we struggle. It's here that we have the problems unless we actually think about them. I've been on a journey for about the last 15 years, I guess it has been, personally. And it began with Big Sandy and doing a master's degree and learning the 7 habits of highly effective people by Covey, and then First Things First, and later on the 8th habit, and then David Kiersey, Please Try to Understand Me Too, the Myers-Briggs, Emotional Intelligence, and the 3 books there. And I've been grinding through this stuff for me for a long time, for a long time. And when you come to understand how us human beings think and are, and the difference between the emotional mind and the logical or rational mind, and you begin to be able to put these things in place and recognize and anticipate our reactions, strike that, why don't we say responses? That's where we should be getting, not to react, but to respond. And get to the place where we respond well. Where we can sit back and say, oops, I can see where I'm going. I can feel this is wrong. Hold on, I'm going to take an intellectual time out here. Smile. Take a deep breath. My hands are getting sweaty, my mouth is dry, I can feel my pulse rate going up, I'm going to, I've been through this before, but nevertheless, how many people do it? How many people do it in their marriage? How many people do it at work? How many mistakes have we made since? So I'm repeating myself, I know. John 15 verse 9. As the Father loved me, I have loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and live in his love. These things I've spoken to you. Let's stop there, 9 and 10. So living in God's love. Living in God's love is having the mind of God and behaving like God. And we are told many places, we don't have time in the sermon to cover that, what that means. Verses 16 and 17. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit, and that your fruit should remain. That whatever you may ask the Father in my name, I may give you. These things I command you, that you love one another, and the word is agape, godly love. Godly love. Romans 1, verse 18. Romans chapter 1, verse 18. Oops. This is a very well-known chapter. And verse 18 of what chapter 1, and we'll read to verse 22. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who suppress the truth or hold back the truth in unrighteousness. And this happens a lot in organisations, religious organisations, because we don't do this here, we do that. Well, what about what Scripture says? Because what may be known of God is manifested in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. And I would stop to pause and ask you this question. If these people are without excuse, do we have an excuse? I don't think so. We have no excuse. We have no excuse. Yes, we can look at the heavens and say, well, God made that, and just pass on our way. There's more to it than that. God put his finger on you and me at some time. When I was 21. You when you were XYZ. Doesn't matter. And it began a journey. And when I go back to 21, I'm in a very, very different place at 70. And so we should be. We get older and meaner and uglier, you know what I mean? We're in a different place. We're different people. We've experienced a lot in life. We've gone through the ups and downs, the ins and outs. What more can it give you in a certain regard? And we are accountable. And we're responsible, not just for keeping a Sabbath, not just for keeping the holidays, not just for not eating clean and unclean foods, but who and what we are in our approach towards the person who's a Jehovah's Witness and knocks on the door and wants to share what she understands or he understands with you. How do you respond? What example do you set? We often see cars, because I'm one of these weird people that like to drive, for the vast majority of the time, and I qualify this because sometimes your just foot's on the accelerator and you don't notice it and you're over the speed limit. I try to keep to the speed limit. I can't tell you the number of cars that go past me with the fish sign on. Boom, boom. And I say, wait a minute, this is incongruous. Why aren't we humble and submissive to the laws of the land? We're told to pay tribute to Caesar. Why can't we obey Caesar's laws for the overall safety of society? Why can't we do that? We're proclaiming to be Christians, and we stick it on the back of our car. There we go. Are we accountable? Yes, indeed we are. We're without excuse. Why? Because although they knew God, they didn't glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. And professing to be wise, they became fools. We have foolish people leading our country today. Why do I say that? Because it's an economic reality. If you continually spend, eventually you will destroy the economic base of your country. I don't care how much money you can print. We're out of touch with reality. That's foolishness. That is foolishness. We've denied God. We've turned our back on God. We've gone away. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 9. 1 Corinthians 5, verse 9. This is the story of problems with a congregation in Corinth putting up with trash, sin. 1 Corinthians 5, verse 9. I wrote you in my epistle not to keep company with the sexually immoral people. Yet I certainly did not mean with the sexually immoral people of this world, or with the covetous or extortioners or idolaters, since then you would need to go out of the world. And that is the only place in life that we can get away in that sense from people who are sinning to one degree or another. We may not know that specifically, but sometimes we may. But now I have written to you not to keep company with anyone named a brother. We have brothers and sisters sitting right here. We are brothers and sisters. We're in the same family. We've got the same identity. We have the same hallmark. That's God's Spirit. We keep the same holy days. We do things together. We're safe here. No one's going to steal from you here. I don't think so anyway. You know what I'm saying? I wouldn't anticipate that. And so on and so on. We can be safe here. This is God's called out assembly of God's people. And when something like this happens, we cannot keep company with them. One named a brother who is a fornicator or covetous or an idolater or a reviler or a drunkard or an extortioner. Don't even eat with someone that way. Don't spend time with them. Now, they may be having a problem. They may deserve all the sympathy in the world. Maybe they've got a problem with drugs or whatever. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. That's understandable. But we've got to deal with it first before we can come back together. We've got to work it out first before we can come back together. That's what God's word says. And so as he goes on to say, don't even eat with such a person. For what have I to do with judging those who are outside? Absolutely nothing at all. Do you not judge those who are inside? And the answer is, yes, we do. Yes, we do. But those who are outside, God judges. Therefore, make a judgment, put the person away. Put the person away. And there's a process for doing that. We put into practice Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. Therefore, if there's any consolation in Christ, if there's any comfort of love, if any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and mercy, Philippians 2 verse 1, fulfill my joy by being like-minded. Being like-minded. Having the same love. Being of one accord or unified, of one mind. We found out that we weren't quite as one-minded as we should be, haven't we? We found that out. We could have and should have resolved that. We didn't do it. We didn't do it. We failed. We failed. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem others better than himself. Is there always room for an apology? Probably in our human relations, there's always room to say, I'm sorry, I could have said that better. I didn't mean to indicate what you thought I meant to indicate. Whatever. Can we grease the situation with an apology? I'm aware of a couple of situations where long, long time members, not here in this area, so don't play any mental games, are at odds. That's gone on for years. One's in one part of the country, the other's in another part of the country, and there's no way, Jose, are we going to settle this. Is that the mind of God? Is that the ministry service of reconciliation? Is that putting our hearts out there and say, okay, I might feel I'm right, but I'm going to just do whatever I need to do to put my heart out there and say, look, let's work this out. What is the problem? Can we get together and talk this about this? We've got to be in that mindset. We've got to have the benefit of the other. As it says here, let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. Shackleton wanted to get to the South Pole. Oh yeah, that was his interest. That was his goal. And he made it the goal of his team as well. But as soon as he saw the others were endangered, he made a calculation for everyone's benefit. That's a wonderful example of a carnal man. Back in 1914 through 16, when World War I was taking place and carnage was taking place, he saved all of his men, 27 of them, alive, safe and sound. We cannot resolve problems sometimes between one another. And I'm talking about others not here, not in this state even. We're sort of sat there on our high horse, stubbornly determined, emotionally engaged, haven't recognized that emotional domain driving us. The rational domain is overridden and nothing happens. Two boxers in a ring. Jesus Christ is the referee in the middle. He says, come out and fight. Now, if you're a boxer and you are in the ring, the object is to fight, to be engaged. Well, let's take the boxing element out of it and put the relationship element in. And Jesus is a referee who sets down the rules of human relationships that we should have. And he says, come on into the middle and look at these rules, and I will adjudicate them. Scripture will tell us, if we need help, fine. And let's resolve this. No, I'm not going to do it. Are we in the same ring? Have we got the mind of Christ? Are we willing to humbly submit? That's a question that's really very important, because we all get our feelings hurt from time to time. We all make mistakes. And we need to be loving and forgiving. The best place we can do that really is in marriage, isn't it? Yeah, that's the best place. But when it comes to extended people and friends, that's different. Shackleton really did this. Chapter 4, 4 through 7. Rejoice in the Lord always, and again I say rejoice, let your gentleness. And the margin says graciousness or forbearing, putting up with. Let your gentleness be made known to all men. What about your neighbour next door? What about the guy down the street you cut off and he gets upset? The best way to get out of a difficulty is to apologise. I was crossing the road a few months back when I was running, and I decided to go round our shopping area parking lot, and I got in the middle of the road, and this car, well, it was quite a high truck with four-wheel drive, and it came racing out there. I said, oh! Boom! I dropped to the ground and lay down flat, and the guy thought he'd knock me over. So I suddenly appeared over his hood, and I said, I'm terribly sorry. You all right? Fine. I guessed instantaneously there was enough height for him to, go over my legs and I'd be okay. I said, I'm fine. I'm sorry, it was my fault. I shouldn't have been in the middle of the road. I was jaywalking. I apologise. Now, I could have had a real Donnybrook. You silly idiot, didn't you see me? What response are we going to have? How are we going to be in resolving problems? Gentle and gracious. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer, supplication with thanksgiving. Let your requests be known to God, and the peace of God which passes all understanding will guard your hearts and minds in Jesus Christ. The peace of God. That's a wonderful wonderful thing to have. If you're agitated, if you're disturbed, if you're discouraged, if you're out of sorts, if you're unhappy, if you're depressed, whatever the problem is, there is a peace of God which he can give us which surpasses all understanding. All understanding. All of it. Don't say some. All. All your. That means everyone in Texas. I want to just encourage you to take a look at this again. I'm about to finish here in a second. Do you recognise it? Message from the council? Did all of you get it? Now, why wife cut it out? These are her markings. She's marked it up with red circles and underlined. It's not mine. But I read through this from Dr. Ward. He's a good man. And he gives certain recommendations as to how to grow spiritually. I'm going to ask you a question which I do not want you to answer. How many of you took that to heart and actually did something about it? Selah, think on this. Choose to grow. Recognize leadership styles and responsibility. Help with the chairs if you have an opportunity. Turn down an offence if you feel it comes to you and say, they didn't mind. They really didn't mean that. Help someone gently to do something. Be kind. Be affectionate. It's a member of the family sitting alongside you, whether it's your husband and wife or not. And love them as God wants us to love each other. If it is attitudes, these responsibilities, this humility, the acceptance of your responsibility before God that helps us learn and grow and understand as human beings until we die. That's the goal. Learning to understand and grow until we die. That's the end result. We don't know when that's going to happen. The man that fell down at the beginning of my story didn't know he was going to walk out there and collapse. I don't know if he lived or died, but he was in pretty bad shape. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Every day is important. What do your neighbours think of you? How tidy is your house? What is your front yard like? Do you tell lousy jokes to the people at the bank because you're cheering them up? What do you do about being joyful and happy and smiling? What do you do? Look up above. That's the example. Look up above. Look to God who says to be this way. Ernest Shackleton was a man, quote, ahead of his time, compared to the England of his day, which was rigid and controlling and domineering and hierarchical. Being called of God invites us to be ahead of our time in attitude, in humility, in kindness and love, and be servants of the heart. And I hope I've given you something to think about.